Hello and welcome to another episode of Nonprofit Vision. This is your host, Greg Nielsen, President and CEO of Nielsen Training and Consulting, where we work with nonprofit organizations all across the country, translating your vision into reality. I want to welcome everybody back to the podcast. It's been a couple of weeks since we've had a new episode. I was privileged and enjoyed a nice vacation getaway with the family, but now back at it, looking forward to a lot of exciting episodes of the podcast in the near future. And I think you're really going to enjoy today's podcast. We have one of the foremost experts in the country on nonprofit social entrepreneurship, social enterprises. I'm pleased to be joined by Mark Lane of Law Offices of Mark Lane. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Greg, pleasure to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
I appreciate you joining us. Mark is an attorney. He is an advisor to nonprofits all across the country in this social entrepreneurship space. Mark, tell us just briefly about your background, how you came to work with so many nonprofits and really develop this passion for social entrepreneurship.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. I'm one of the blessed ones whose personal passions and professional interests are aligned. I was a child of the 60s, deeply involved in social issues my whole life. Became an attorney who was practicing in corporate and tax law, principally represent high income, high net worth individuals and their closely held businesses. And about 15 years ago, I found a way to flex that muscle to drive positive social change. So since that time, I've been deeply immersed in the evolving social impact ecosystem.
Mark, one of the things that I love most about your background is this focus on nonprofit entrepreneurship. And I think one of the myths out there nationally, not among nonprofit leaders, is that nonprofits aren't necessarily entrepreneurial. And in reality, I see it, and I know you see it every day, myriad ways in which nonprofits are being innovative, are starting social entrepreneurships, social enterprises. Why and how do you see nonprofits becoming more entrepreneurial?
Well, it's of necessity. Organizations need to be financially sustainable if they're to achieve their missions. And most have historically been dependent upon two sources of funding, government contracts and grants, and philanthropy. Government at every level is broke, and philanthropy has too many charities chasing too few dollars. And when you have a situation where policy officers and other impact investors have so many choices and can change their objectives, nonprofits have to find a way to be self-reliant. And entrepreneurship affords them the ability to diversify their sources of revenue and be better stewards of the resources entrusted to them.
So I work with a lot of nonprofit organizations. I do a lot of strategic planning, and this issue of social entrepreneurship comes up frequently, just as you said, in terms of diversifying our revenue streams, helping us as an organization be more sustainable year over year. I'm curious, from in your advising of organizations, how do you ensure that organizations that are going into these businesses or starting or opening new revenue streams don't jeopardize their tax exemption in the process of doing so?
Yeah, well, first is the selection of the business is key. You want to make sure that you're looking at the organization's core competencies and underutilized assets, and ideally identify a business opportunity that will drive mission, such that the revenue that would be derived from that business will, in fact, further the exempt purpose of the nonprofit. When you do that, you avoid taxation of the revenue and you avoid jeopardizing the tax exemption. So that's kind of the principal way of playing this. There are some structural alternatives that are available to organizations that are creating and running businesses that may be marginal. They think it may drive the exempt purpose, but they're not positive about it. In those cases, we can establish a subsidiary or affiliates to own and operate the business and have an election for that entity be taxed as a corporation. The revenue that then comes back to the nonprofit escapes the tax definition of unrelated business taxable income. So there again, you're not going to be jeopardizing tax exemption. But from a strategic point of view, you want to make sure the business is not itself a distraction. It, in fact, is part of the core competency of what the nonprofit is seeking to accomplish, and it actually enhances the management of the nonprofit's capacity to drive social change.
Mark, it reminds me of our oath, our duty as attorneys to make sure that you ensure competency in anything that you are doing with a client, right? And I think that that's what I hear you saying as it relates to nonprofit organizations. Ensure that you have the capacity and the competency to do this and ensure that it aligns with and furthers your mission.
You know, Greg, we've seen situations historically where nonprofits chase a specific funding stream, whether it be a grant opportunity or some impact investor who raises his hand, and now they're off to the races in a totally different direction. When that money evaporates, they've lost their way. And how do they come back to the reason for which the organization was organized and operated in the first place? So it's important to stick to your knitting. And it seems to me the board and leadership of the nonprofit has a fiduciary obligation to ensure that all of the decisions that are made further the exempt purpose of the nonprofit. Otherwise, it seems to me they're swinging at pitches they ought not be swinging at.
And Mark, you mentioned the board, and that's always been my passion, is working with nonprofit boards. And it strikes me that this is a shift for boards to get their mind around. As you said, you know, traditionally we think of nonprofit organizations with government contracts and grants and individual donors. Social enterprise is a different kind of animal for boards to get their minds around. For nonprofit leaders or boards that may be putting a toe in the water in this space, how do you recommend that they think about that strategic shift or some of the questions that they should ask themselves at the outset?
Well, I'm a process guy, and I always believe that before embarking upon the consideration of a social enterprise initiative, there's create an opportunity for the board to raise questions with appropriate financial and legal advisors about what are the risks, what are the opportunities, disabuse them of the misinformation to which they might have been exposed, but get them comfortable with the idea. Often that is accomplished first by identifying a champion within the organization that gets it, understands it, is lobbying for it. That doesn't mean necessarily that the organization is well suited to pursue an entrepreneurial strategy, but now you have somebody that the board is going to trust. And when that champion brings in a professional advisor or team to consider with the board kind of where they're at in their growth cycle, what risk tolerance is appropriate for them, what kinds of money or other resources need to be put at risk to make this happen or even to explore it, and answer the technical questions that are likely to come up. You've already raised one. Is this going to jeopardize our tax exemption? Will donors misperceive why we're doing this and think, well, they don't need us anymore, so you're going to lose your donors? It'll be perceived optically by other stakeholders as pursuing a commercial rather than charitable agenda. Well, all those questions are legitimate, but they all have good answers. So I think the process by which this is considered is really going to put you on the right path so that should a decision be made to get into a business, the nonprofit will feel good about it and the chances of success are increased exponentially.
Mark, I'm a visual person. I'm a visual learner. And I like to paint a picture of, and I often ask my clients this question, what would it look like if it worked? And I know that in your experience, in your practice, you've seen countless nonprofits go through this analysis that you just referenced and develop a successful social enterprise. I wonder if you could maybe just talk to us about one of those success stories you may have seen in your career.
Well, there are all kinds of success stories, and how you define success is really key to whether or not you should get into this in the first place. Because to me, you need to have both financial and social returns on investment. So the thing needs to be significantly self-reliant in terms of supporting its economics. But there also needs to be measurable social impact that derives from the business itself. And it has to fit in an integrated way, seamlessly with the way in which the nonprofit operates. So when you're talking about an embryonic nonprofit, and many of them are, where they're looking at earned revenue from the get-go, we'll have a different kind of conversation than a seasoned nonprofit that's been around for decades. We represent, for example, an organization in Chicago called A Safe Haven, which I think has 23 different nonprofit and for-profit affiliates. They have a cohesive approach to affordable housing, supporting of veterans, people with alcohol and drug problems, other marginalized populations. They have workforce development programs. We have a multiplicity of for-profit entities, all of them driving social change. But we also have relationships with nonprofit organizations. They have three of those. And then they have L3Cs and other social enterprise forms that all fit into the mix. Well, that's not everybody's cup of tea, nor is that recommended for everybody. But we often have embryonic would-be social entrepreneurs come sit down with us and say, should we do this as a nonprofit? Should we do this as a for-profit? How does that work? And that itself is an analysis that leads to a conclusion that fits well for that entrepreneur, that mission, and what they're trying to accomplish and how they're going about it. Often we'll recommend a hybrid approach where you bifurcate mission, create a nonprofit to secure tax deductible donations and grants to pursue essentially soft cost type items like research and education and outreach, and put the operating business in a for-profit subsidiary controlled by the nonprofit. And that's, and then you, from an asset protection point of view, you've mitigated any liability of that business that's controlled by the nonprofit. You also have created a for-profit entity that can actually sell shares to investors. Of course, nonprofits have no shares to sell. So, and then the nonprofit and the for-profit operate harmoniously, where the revenue from the for-profit subsidiary is upstream to the parent to be deployed programmatically. So there's lots of different ways to design these things, lots of different structures, and form follows function.
Mark, we're just talking about different legal structures, and you mentioned a couple of parent subsidiary form. For nonprofit leaders that are listening, how do they, or what are the considerations they should have? When should they house this business, this social enterprise, in a separate legal entity? What are there trigger points? Are there, you know, kind of parameters or places where they reach in developing that social enterprise? How do you advise organizations to think about, can we still house this under our 501c3 nonprofit? Do we need to think about a separate legal entity? What are some of the key questions in that analysis?
Yeah, well, I think first you need to differentiate between a program and a business, because often those are misperceived. If this is to be a program of the venture, of the nonprofit, it can generally comfortably reside within the nonprofit. As soon as you're not talking about a business, subject to all of the risks and opportunities of businesses, you start thinking about, well, how should we house this in a separate entity? So if there is any liability that comes from it contractually, from a tort point of view, reputationally, if it doesn't right work, we probably want to have that in a separate legal entity, which is nevertheless controlled by the nonprofit, but can be cut off from the nonprofit if it needs to be. So, and then there are tax implications to that decision, and there are different entity choices that are available for that for-profit entity.
It strikes me as one of the, as a very similar conversation, at least at the outset, to what we have in strategic planning, which is how well do you as an organization understand for your programs and services for your organization, the difference between your customers and your consumers? Your customers may be those that you are directly providing services or programs for, your consumers, who's paying for that. And I know that in a nonprofit setting, a traditional 501c3, they may be different. You know, those that you're providing services for may be different than your donors and your funders. For-profit situation may blend those a little bit more, but it's an important question to ask for a new line of business or a new revenue stream.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right, Greg. And obviously, when you're talking about a business, you're talking about selling a product or selling a service, and not necessarily to the population that is to be served by the nonprofit. If in fact it is a nonprofit that's seeking to empower a marginalized community, for example. But they need to be aligned. They need to make sense together. They need to be harmonized. But as soon as you start operating in a commercial environment where you're competing in a marketplace, all of a sudden, it seems to me you're now in a business mode and you need to take all of the steps that any business outside the nonprofit context would need to take to protect itself and to optimize its financial rewards, but in this case as well, its social impact.
Now, Mark, a few minutes ago, you used a term L3C in your comments. And I know many of our listeners are probably familiar with different business structures like an LLC. You know, they have obviously their 501c3 status. Can you first tell us what is a L3C, which I know stands for low profit, limited liability company? Give us just kind of the layperson's overview of what is an L3C.
Yeah, Greg. Well, I wrote the law creating L3Cs, and it's the only for-profit business form in the United States that places mission above all other objectives permanently and irrevocably by statute. Obviously, that doesn't cut against sustainability. That's an obligation every venture has. But it has a few features. One is first of all, I should tell you, it is a form of LLC. It is a very popular form among nonprofits that are seeking to create a subsidiary to hold their businesses or an affiliate to hold their businesses. And one of the reasons for that is the L3C by law tracks all of the federal tax requirements for foundations that want to invest what's called program-related investments, a specialized form of venture investments that's for charitable or educational purposes that would count for the foundation just as a grant would. Grants, foundations, of course, are obligated to distribute 5% of their assets annually for charitable or similar purposes. This is what accounts for the feverish competition for grants among charities. Well, what's less understood is foundations can meet that 5% distribution requirement through grants, commonly do, but also can make investments, these so-called program-related investments, that also drive social change in even a for-profit entity. So the L3C is facilitating these program-related investments into subsidiaries or affiliates of nonprofits. It's a significant feature because to the extent that the foundation makes a grant or investment in the L3C subsidiary, what it's really doing is subsidizing returns for other investors who come in concurrently or subsequently because the foundation is denied the right to bargain for market rate returns. So it attracts capital from other impact investors and in time, traditional financial first investors as well. So it has a very significant capital formation attribute, the L3C does. It also has a governance feature, which is particularly important in that it galvanizes all stakeholders around mission permanently and irrevocably as well. The L3C is not an entity that is intended primarily to maximize financial returns. And if a prospective investor is in the room to maximize financial returns, he or she will excuse herself. And that's what the social entrepreneur would like to see happen. You want to make sure everybody's on the same page. And the L3C actually makes that happen. And then finally, the L3C has a branding or positioning or signaling advantage. Every L3C in the country has L3C in its name. So customers of the L3C, for example, or other stakeholders will recognize that even though this is a business, it's there for a charitable purpose. So there's no misunderstanding about why is my nonprofit pursuing a commercial opportunity rather than pursuing only its exempt charitable purpose. They're all together, and the L3C just helps make that happen. It also has some interesting tax play because the L3C can be a disregarded entity owned for tax purposes, owned by the nonprofit. So all of the earnings of the L3C in furtherance of the exempt purpose of the parent come back to the nonprofit without any tax consequence, or are reinvested in the growth of the L3C, or a combination of the two. So you have a lot of flexibility in terms of tax planning, in terms of management. It can be a participatory democracy where all the stakeholders join forces to make major decisions, or it can be hierarchical where the nonprofit's board runs it directly, or a designee of the nonprofit's board manages it, and it has tax flexibility as well. So the L3C is regarded by some to be the optimal form to hold businesses that are owned by nonprofits.
Mark, is the L3C available in every state?
Yes, it is. I think there are now 10 states that specifically authorize the organization of an L3C, and as well as Puerto Rico and two Native American reservations. But just as you can have a Delaware corporation operate in any state, you can have an L3C organized in one of those domiciles and then register it in your own state if your state isn't one of them. So we have L3C clients, I think, in all 50 states now.
Wonderful. So, Mark, for those who are embarking on this process, if a nonprofit organization believes they have a viable social enterprise, they believe it aligns with their mission, what are some of the considerations they should be asking themselves in selecting a financial or legal advisor to provide them some guidance in many of the questions that you posed in the podcast today? Are there specific experiences or specific affiliations that organizations should look for to make sure they're getting solid advice?
Well, one of the attractive features about practicing in social impact law as I do is that it is not tied to a traditional practice area within the legal community. The nonprofit is going to need to look at tax issues, tax-exempt issues, fiduciary issues, contract issues, corporate issues, employment issues, intellectual property issues, and others. To do this right, as you would in most of those cases with any business. So you'll want to have an attorney or other financial advisor or a group of financial advisors and attorneys who have expertise in all those relevant areas. But I think initially you're going to want to look at kind of what is the business model to look like? The business model will drive the entity design. The entity design will drive the funding strategy. So you look at this kind of sequentially as building blocks. So I think you want to start with an attorney that has some grounding in social enterprise, but really has expertise in terms of business counseling and tax planning, financial planning, because that's where you start. You're going to be looking at this first as a business, but you also want somebody who's going to be able to field the informed questions of the board and leadership of the nonprofit. Otherwise, you'll never get beyond the starting gates.
And Mark, one of the analyses that we use with nonprofits all the time is understanding where they are in their organizational life cycle. You referenced embryonic organizations earlier. Is an organization growing? Are they mature? Are they stagnant? Are they in a state of decline? It seems to me that organizations that have social enterprises also want to understand where is that social enterprise in its life cycle. Are we incubating it and just starting out? Is it matured, to the point where we might be reinventing it or reimagining it? Where is it in its life cycle? I wonder if those questions typically come up with your clients as well.
Yeah, very definitely. I like to define what success ultimately would look like and then reverse engineer to where you're at now so you could take one foot in front of another to get there over time. But more and more nonprofits are kind of doing two things that I encourage them to do. One is recognize that whatever they believe their mission to be, thought leadership is part of their mission. So to the extent that they signal to the rest of the nonprofit community, as well as funders and others, what they're doing, proclaim their successes, acknowledge their failures so they can abandon that which is not working and tweak it, and ultimately look to what they might do in order to leverage their successes, how we scale this up. More and more nonprofits that have businesses are growing them through replication in other communities throughout the country or throughout the world. They're looking at strategic alliances with other nonprofits to take their successes and expand their social impact. We're looking at social enterprise franchising. The point of these things is really to ensure that you're optimizing your social impact and at the same time further diversifying your revenue through royalties or partnership relationships. Much of this often is looking at your intellectual property. We look at intellectual property more broadly than attorneys might, because it seems to me that's an asset that doesn't appear on the balance sheet, yet often can be monetized in creative ways, especially as a business grows. And then how do you then take that information and continue to grow it outside the sphere of influence of the nonprofit so that others can join the party in collaboration with the nonprofit, and the nonprofit can flex that muscle in new and different ways and achieve social impact in ways they never imagined?
Mark, I appreciate you taking the time to join us today. You have literally written the book on this topic. For those who want more information or would like to connect with you and your firm directly, what is the best way for folks to get in touch with you?
Oh, very kind of you. Well, our website, it's mlane, M-L-A-N-E, at Mark J. Lane, M-A-R-C-J-L-A-N-E, all one word, markjlane.com. Or they can call me at 1-800-372-1040. And I'm on LinkedIn and Facebook, and I'd happy to meet the members of your audience. And Greg, I'm delighted to have spent this time with you. Thanks so much for including me.
Mark, I'm delighted that you made time to join us today. I want to also thank our listeners of the podcast. As our community continues to grow, I really value and appreciate this community of leaders that we're building together. Just a reminder for our listeners, if you're enjoying the podcast, share it with your friends, your colleagues in nonprofit leadership so that we can continue to grow this community. If you're really enjoying the podcast, leave us a rating and a review on your favorite podcast platform. That helps us get noticed, helps us continue to grow. Mark, thank you again. I appreciate your time and value your expertise.
Truly a pleasure. Thanks again.
And I hope everybody out there stay safe, stay well, and we'll be back soon with additional podcast episodes.